Well, I think I would center the thoughts I want to present to you this morning on the Bible and its significance for both preachers and laymen. And I think, and I want you to remember that I'm speaking as a layman, so probably the professional theologians and pastors present will have quite a few arguments against my point of view. I'm speaking as a layman, I'm speaking as a writer of poetry, as a teacher of literature, and that of course colors my presentation, my point of view, I cannot avoid it. It seems to me that the Bible is God's revelation in and through poetry. The Psalms, the Song of Songs, the parables of Jesus, all of these are intense, concrete, moving poetry, fresh as on the day it was uttered. I quote at random from the Psalms. I am poured out like water, and all my bones are out of joint. My heart is like wax, it is melted in the midst of my bowels. My strength is dried up like a potsherd. Or, for day and night, thy hand was heavy upon me. My moisture is turned into the drought of summer. Or, deep calleth unto deep at the noise of thy waterspouts. All thy waves and thy billows are gone over me. The prophet Jeremiah, the Lamentations of Job, are among the greatest works of world literature, even for a non-believer. Now you've heard this assertion, I'm sure, before, many times, but have you ever thought out the implications of this fact for you as an exegete of the Bible, as a preacher? Now, if the Bible does not use poetry, and it doesn't use always poetry, strictly, it is breathtaking narrative, often very lusty at that, lustier than most Puritans who read it. It's great drama, where God and the angels and the devil and demons participate in a very exciting fashion. And I think this is the reason that the Bible has inspired 2 millennia of Western art and literature, both as a divine revelation and great literature. I think the Bible is universal. First of all, because it is the revelation of God, but also because it is steeped in human reality. It is experienced with all the senses, all the appetites, all the sensibilities, with all the confusions, the doubts, and the glories of the human reality. It is, however, not a book of purely abstract speculation. It is not systematic philosophy, nor is it systematic theology, or a set of scholastic exercises. It moves on all levels, intellectual, spiritual, mystical, visionary, sensuous, sensitive, imaginative, symbolic, on all these levels at once. And therefore, it is truly inexhaustible. And not just in metaphor, but in the reality of 2,000 years of reading, probing, and commenting. Now, I think it is important that God's revelation then has not despised the means of artistic imagination. It has not despised the rhythms and the images of poetry. In the Bible, the Spirit has been incarnated in the flesh of the sensuous human poetic word. Christ is the supreme incarnation, but actually the whole Bible is, to my mind, one web of great symbols and images that make the thought revealed in it palpably real. Now, there is nothing more painful than to hear a passage from this poetical book followed by an impersonal, flat, cliché-ridden, stylistically insensitive, abstractly speculative, anemic, sentimental, unpoetic sermon. The liturgy is a poetic echo of the Bible passages read, but the sermon is often pious journalism or a legalistic squabble or philosophical speculation above most of the heads of the congregation or below. There is a painful gap between the intense, concrete, imaginative, great art of the Bible and the often phony church architecture. Pseudo-Gothic is closer to God. Church art, the sugary realism, almost pop art, religious pop art, I like to call it. Church music, of course we know Gregorian chants and medieval music and Bach and the Baroque, Stravinsky and the moderns are too difficult. Now why this fear of the genuine, original, creative, and a constant flight into the insincere, the second-rate, the imitative? If the congregation's laziness prefers the insincere, the second-rate, the imitative, then it seems to me it is the task of the pastor to educate them gradually, slowly, to point the way towards a sacral art that matches in contemporary terms the poetic intensity and originality of the Bible. Now what about the sermon? Am I asking from the pastor that he have the fiery eloquence of an Old Testament prophet and the poetical immediacy of a poet? Am I setting up an impossibly high standard for the average pastor? Now I'm used to being accused of this, and snobbery and other similar niceties. Well, I personally, and I can only speak personally for myself, I do not think so. What am I then recommending? I think that pastors too be children of God, like their parishioners. That they too step down from the throne or the pedestal of the pulpit to the level of common humanity. That they cease being oracles, abstract philosophers, judges, lawyers, psychoanalysts, and entertaining journalists, and become more like the poets who spoke and wrote the Bible. Now you may wonder what characterizes a poet, in my opinion, a poet in the larger sense, who doesn't even write a line of poetry. I would say, above all, that the personal is always preferable to the impersonal. That the concrete perception is to be preferred to abstract speculation. Really, better stammer and get entangled in your syntax if it makes the language you use your own more personal, more concrete. Bear personal witness to the truths of the Bible and quote less the wisdom of others. Do not pretend that you have a complexity or a simplicity that is not your own. You can all err both ways. You can pretend that you have a simplicity of the common people when you are really a very complex intellectual, and you can also pretend the complexity when basically you are very simple. There is no value judgment implied in saying someone is intellectually very keen and the other one less so. The main thing is that you are yourself. Then I think what you say will have relevance. The lie, I think, is born quite often from the good intentions. And because you have good intentions, you try to be more complex than you are, or you try to be more simple than you are. And I think hearers and readers, and I speak from experience as a teacher, can detect insincerity in a teacher or a preacher at once. So, dare to be yourself in your thoughts, in your feelings, in your style, in your witness. I think the Bible really needs no commercials, nor propaganda in an established parish. What it does need, I think, is a living encounter. Don't tell so much how your parishioner should apply its truths. Stress more how you, as a human being, as a child of God, wrestle with them. Apply them yourself. Dare to be at times puzzled, oppressed by these tremendous truths. Yes, indeed, you, the pastor, too, really should be oppressed, depressed, sometimes almost wavering. And when you present this personal kind of encounter with the Bible, in your own words, trying to use images that belong to you, I think, do not spell out everything. You may hint at problems. Leave some of the confusion that exists in your mind in your presentation. The parishioners will understand you better because their minds are filled with contradictions and confusions. And it's this dazzling perfection, this floating above the waters, you know, as a pure spirit, which frightens many a parishioner, I think, away from a pastor and from the message that he has. In hinting at some of these problems, in leaving some things frankly unresolved, for the time being, at least, you do respect the creative individuality of your listeners. You ask them to participate in your presentation. They can fill in some of the things that you have only alluded to. Their imagination, their own sensibilities are awakened, and they want to complete it. They may even come to you and say, the problem that you have, I have solved. And I think if this is really sincerely done, the pastor should be only thankful to this. But it may well be that someone in your parish has overcome this particular problem, while of course you may help them with some other problem. But this kind of this feeling of community, this feeling, I mean, that you do not set yourself above the rest, I think comes through if you are groping for your own expression, if you dare to be yourself, not only in your thought, but also in your language. Teach less and confront more. Let them into your own process of thinking. Let the listener participate in the process of your thinking, of your maturing, of your finding. There is nothing more inhuman, to my mind, than a teacher or a preacher who knows everything. What is he to do anymore in the sinful world, you know? If he has all the answers, if he has solved all the problems, all he can do is hand out the capsules every day, like vitamins, and the parish swallows them. He doesn't have to take them. He is the capsule. Now faith, and I was the first one to say this, is drama. It is not an idol. Even Holden is essentially a drama. Every living encounter with one's fellow men, if it is really openly and honestly conducted, is an encounter, is a dramatic encounter, where there is give and take and modification in the process, and of course some head-on collision. Faith is drama, not an idol, a pastoral idol, if I may pun. It is a constant probing, a testing, a meeting, a seeking, a finding, and a departing again towards new problems. Now this dynamic movement, this drama, this living quality, this personal immediacy, must be reflected in the language of your sermons, or you better stick to the reading of the Bible passages, the liturgy, and good a cappella choir singing, than trying to imitate the Saturday Evening Post or Paul Tillich. There is perhaps no greater boldness, real courage, than to dare to be yourself and to express yourself not in the quotes of others or the cliches of yesteryear, but in your own, however limited, language. One pastor told me, he said, well, you know, one of my real problems is I have a limited vocabulary. I replied to him that there are some very fine poets who have a very limited vocabulary. Not everybody has a Shakespearean range. But you can husband your talent wisely. And even with a limited vocabulary, if you use it in a personal way, you can achieve quite great things. Now this is the first lesson I think that poetry can teach you. The second thing that poetry can teach you is the insight, and some of you who heard me on Monday must forgive that I am repeating some of these things, that the how is as important as the what. That form and contents are interdependent. In the Bible, the truth of God is revealed to us not in any kind of naked, abstract, philosophical form as pure contents. It's a phantom. There is no such thing as pure contents. But embodied, dramatized, poetically immediate, concrete, and therefore moves us, it grasps us, we say, this spoke to a human situation in time, in reality, thousands of years back, and therefore it still speaks today. I think you have learned enough about the what of the Bible. This is what's being stressed all the time. The message, the contents, the truth. But you may know all too little, it seems to me, about the how. The use of words, of images, of rhythms, that have made the Bible the great book it is. Now in the Bible, and I never tire really of stressing this, form and contents are marvelously one. Intention and realization are in perfect accord. This is one of the big problems, you see, of a minor poet, a poor speaker, that he has these marvelous intentions, that he has this great message at his hand, but the realization doesn't match or doesn't live up to these intentions. So, you have to learn to use the instrument. And by the way, if you think of a musician, all right, there is the music, but how do you communicate the music? You have to learn to play the instrument. It takes many years. It isn't enough just to make noises. You really have to learn what you can do with your instrument, how you can make it expressive, how you can really communicate what you have to say with that instrument through that music. Now with language, for some reason, people think, because all of us are born into the language, we learn to speak it early as children, but there's really nothing to learn. Yes, a sculptor must learn to handle clay. He must learn how to work with stone. A painter must learn about color and line and texture and perspective. And it takes long practice until really he can put across the vision that he has in his mind. Not so the speaker or the writer, for some reason. I don't know why. We are all being fooled, I think, and tricked into kind of an underestimation of the word. And then we are surprised that with all our good intentions and with the great truths that we have received, that the moment we utter them, the moment we communicate them, they kind of turn sour in our mouth and they fall dead in front of our feet. So I think the how and the what. I'm not saying that the what is less important or not important, far from it. I'm just concerned, how can you communicate? We talk so much about dialogue, about communication. And the artist, I think, the poet, the writer, has solved this, or at least working consciously at it. Whereas so often teachers and preachers seem to believe that they have the knowledge, they have the wisdom, they have the facts, and all they have to do is open their mouth and say it, and it will be understood. Well, it isn't. It may be understood, but it is not experienced. You may, the other person may register it, what you're saying, but it doesn't really come through to you, it doesn't appeal to your humanity, it doesn't really ring true. Now, this interdependence of form and contents, which is so marvelously present in the Bible, and think of it, that the Bible is a translation. We don't, most of us don't read it in the original, the Hebrew or Greek original. Even in translation, we sense this tremendous unity. You can imagine what great poetry this is. Very often poetry loses in translation. Well, the Bible comes through in several languages. It has kindled the imagination of great translators who are poets themselves. The English King James Version, Luther's German Bible. These are monuments in the language. Great poetry. So, how to bring together intention and realization, form and contents? This is really an ideal that the Bible demonstrates to us. And it's an ideal that all who use language, I think, must strive for. Now, if you begin to see the significance of this, you will discover also that thought and sense perception, that the mind and the body, that man and nature, that the secular and the sacred are inseparably bound together, and that you have all too long played with dichotomies and dualisms which are purely theoretical and abstract, instead of facing the one complex human reality here and now. We know here and now in the flesh. And these dichotomies, you know, this world and the next, you know, mind and body and theory and praxis and contents and form, we just juggle with them like a juggler with his very nice and many-colored balls. Is it grounded, however, in our immediate experience? These dichotomies, these contrasts, these antinomies are very handy, you know, for any teacher. But you can get so far carried away that you just opt for one and say, I put all my eggs into the basket of the other world, and to hell with this world. Really, I mean it literally, I'm not just here being vulgar, I hope. And so, you begin to live in another reality. You say, well, I'm spiritual. I'm above this. My eyes are another world and not in this valley of tears, you know. And then you stop seeing the social reality around you, the social drama being enacted in the streets of our cities. You cease to suffer almost along with those who have not reached that plateau on which you stand. So this complex human reality here and now, which is really one, it's very hard to face that. It's much easier to play with abstract concepts. And this is the biggest shock, I think, that poetry teaches. That it is really much easier to speculate and to talk in the abstract than to perceive the uniqueness of the concrete situation. Whether it is a place, a person, a truth, a tree, a flower, a feeling, it is really much harder really to put it into words to perceive the uniqueness of it. It's easy to play around with big concepts, you know, like freedom and truth and goodness and mercy and resurrection, but really, trying to see them embodied, to make them palpably real, to liquefy these rocks of truth in our common experience, that is really the task which is in front of us. The preachers do it on the level of religion, the poets do it on the level of more immediate experience, without always metaphysical pretense or metaphysical goals. So the careful, attentive reading of poetry, and here again I include the novel and the drama, because at their best they are poetical and not just prosy chit-chat or reporting. This careful, attentive reading of poetry from the Psalms to T.S. Eliot, to Wallace Stevens, I think can check your spiritual pride, your attempts of floating away to some kind of an abstract space of perfection, and make you, I think, understand better the mystery of incarnation. Because this seems to me really the crux of the matter. Not the existence of the spirit and the God on the one hand, and matter and nature on the other, but their meeting, the fact that you and I sit here in the flesh. And yet, we think together, we feel together, we talk about mind and matter, about God. And this complex, insoluble kind of reality is here with us. And this reality seems to me, this really incarnated reality, is to me the greatest mystery. And instead of trying to understand this mystery, this interpenetration of these different areas, we separate them. We simplify unduly. We kind of cleave the Gordian knot and say, look at it. It's just a bunch of cords. And the intricacy of the knot, we kind of disregard. So, from the incarnation of Christ, who became man and dwelt among us, what does it mean? You know? What does it really mean? It means really the humanity of Christ. So often, you know, if you read the New Testament, I'm surprised again and again that Christ is groping for an answer. You know. Just from the time like that, you know, he has everything ready, you know. Here he is, God becoming incarnate among man, and he just dishes out all the answers. No, he vacillates. He thinks for a while. He ponders. And I don't think there's merely show. But since he really has entered the human sphere, these doubts, these vacillations, this seeking is part of the human condition. And he really assumed it. So it's not merely, some of us, I think, when we talk about Christ's incarnation, speak in terms of masquerade almost, as if God just holding forth a mask there, and really we all know it was all planned and all done, you know, and everything went like clockwork. I don't think so. I think that really Christ had to feel his way into his manhood to fill out this dramatic possibility, suffer it really in every fiber of his body, sense it with every nerve. And because, you see, he did that, I think we have no right to avoid this experience, this faith as a kind of living drama, as an incarnation, and not to take easy shortcuts out into the beyond, or into the spiritual, or into the material. This is what we are doing all the time. All the time talking about extremes, about polarities, you know, and juggling with abstract concepts, instead of really opening ourselves up to one another, to the complexity that each of us is, the complexity of nature around us. This takes humility. It's much easier to be proud than to be humble. And this humility before the complexity of each individual person, humility before the complexity of the world, it has to be learned. I think it's a lifelong process. I think you find if you're a teenager, usually you know everything. You're very proud. You're on top of everything. First of all, you are much smarter than your parents. You think you can solve the problems of society. You rebel. You're a revolutionary. You are separate, alone. Inwardly, you may be miserable. But at least, this is the first reaction. And then really, the coming of wisdom is that you discover that there are few things that really can be solved so neatly. And then you can despair of this complexity, or you can learn to live with it, enter it, participate, and share it with others. And I think here at home, spiritual pride is made very difficult for us, thank God. You simply cannot overlook the mountains. You simply cannot overlook the power of the waterfall. you simply cannot concentrate just on Bible study or theological speculation. And that's good so. Because when you leave Holden, you do not return to the world, you continue in the world. And so I think that the poets are not really so exclusive, so far from the concerns of the rest of mankind, kind of aesthetic jewelers who produce nice little clockworks that rhyme and ring, but that they have looked at reality, and instead of coming up with simple solutions, they simply stand in awe and marvel at the complexity of it. Some poets celebrate and praise this complexity and see in it God's creation. For example, Gerard Manley Hopkins does it. Other poets despair of this complexity. There are some poets who attack it and say, why this complexity? Why does God thrust us into these contradictions? But I think any poet worth his salt will not try to get out of this complexity. And so I think for preachers and laymen alike who read the Bible, remember that if you are gripped by it, if the message comes through, if lines ring in your ear and you just can't forget certain expressions of Job or Jeremiah, it is because of the poetry, which captures somehow the relevancy of these deep truths expressed, that they really come home and they stay with us. Because the Bible does not set itself up above the rest of mankind, but it enters it. And it enters it through poetry, which is concrete and is not ashamed of man's humanity. Well, I think I'll stop these remarks here. And if you have any questions, I'd be very happy
to. I'd like to hear you quote that Robert Frost again at the end of that piece, that you have it there. Do you have it handy to you?
Yes, I have introduced my.
On the suggestibility of the passage of language.
And then I have another quote I'd like to read the page too, if you don't mind. It is from the book by Arthur C. McGill, The Celebration of Flesh, Poetry and Christian Life. And he analyzes three American poets, T.S. Eliot, Robert Frost, and Wallace Stevens. And at the end of his analysis, he kind of tries to face what he has discovered in their reading as a theologian, as a pastor. And one of the, I'll read these two quotes. First of all, in the chapter on Frost, McGill concludes, a speaker must always so fashion his statements as that he gives room to the perceptiveness and imagination of those who hear him. He must not say too much. The teacher who explains everything, or the lover who puts all his feelings into words, is depriving others of an active role and is unwittingly degrading them. Everyone who speaks must recognize the distance, the abyss that lies between himself and other men. Far as we aim our signs to reach, far as we often make them reach, across the soul from soul abyss, there is an eon limit set beyond which they are doomed to miss. The speaker must want and affirm this distance, continues McGill, in the style of all his statements. In other words, he must at times be content with hints, and not try to make up for a possible lack of response in others by smothering them with clear-cut statements. He must invite their sympathetic initiative. He must let them know that this distance can and should be crossed only when they, for reasons wholly their own and forever inaccessible to him, let their minds reach toward him. He must be as respectful of their integrity in his speaking as he is of the integrity of places and tools in his work. And then he continues on the next page. The Christian community has been reluctant to absorb the images, the rhythms, and the despairs of this human sphere revealed in the city. It has preferred to help men escape from the city world, trying to give them an inspirational attitude toward their dreary work, trying to foster a cult of personal love between each of them and their 4 million immediate neighbors, trying to encourage individualized morality in a society of mass movements. It has failed to accept the feel and taste of urban existence and to be confident in the sufficiency of God's grace even there. It has given a completely false impression that Christians cannot thrive in the midst of loneliness or violence or emotional emptiness, that they must operate only within a cozy, intimate situation of person-to-person fellowship. Whenever Christian churches become caught up in this kind of evasion, they betray themselves in their language. Their sermons and prayers have a way of creating an atmosphere far removed from the daily life. In its phrasing and rhythms, their speech seems to belong to some bygone or artificial world. That is why poets like Eliot, who explore the new sound values in everyday speech and who thereby bring the new conditions of immediacy into focus, are always of indispensable service to the Christian humanity, Christian community, excuse me. And then he concludes here. The importance of this problem, however, must not be taken to mean that Christian discourse has no other task but that of keeping up to date, that it should commit itself unreservedly to prevailing habits of speech. The first allegiance of Christians is to their Lord. Because their Lord has created and sustained the actual world, has himself entered into it and made it his own, and has made them his instruments for his complete redemption, this actual world must be included in their allegiance to him. But what is this actual world of their fleshly existence? Is it that disclosed by the current habits of daily speech? In part, yes, but only in part. For while daily speech is particularly responsive to certain aspects of immediacy, it also is also negligent of others. Like every act of the human consciousness, it is selective in providing a rich perception of some of the things that engage human life at any moment, it persistently avoids others. This means that the language of the Christian community cannot simply absorb the prevailing habits of speech. In certain respects, it must also surpass and even counteract them. That is, insofar as they obscure the concrete life of flesh. It must not be simply up to date. It must be Catholic, in the traditional meaning of the term, representing within itself, as a subject of God's life-giving grace, every variety of immediate human perception. It must therefore speak always in a variety of living styles. While not turning its back on new patterns of idiom and rhythm, neither must it limit itself to these. Well, I just wanted to read these quotes to point out the relevancy, I think, and the interest that this book can have to just very practical problems of application.
Question on your comment on abstract thinking and abstract speaking. When Kierkegaard talks about a wave of speculation, and I suppose he did find an example of a poet who lived in that, who had confidence in abstract thought, who is a superb dialectician, who does create order out of thought. Isn't it true that you kind of make a circuit? You start as a child in the world of the concrete, and you move into a certain competence in abstract, in the abstract. But since the abstract has no power to evoke either emotion or action, then your next task is to move out of the abstract. And I think your discourse today is a fine example of abstract thinking. You really weren't the poet today. You made us do abstract thinking. Now, can a preacher or a poet be effective if at some point or another he does not engage in hard, solid abstract thinking?
Perhaps we could read it here. Of course. You see, this is why I would put the stress not so much on the concrete, but on this problem of incarnation. That the thought, on this slide, that there is thought, you see, that there is message, that it must really manifest itself in a concrete action, in the dramatic, you see, presentation. And I would certainly in no way run down the quality of the of abstraction or of thinking, and if this impression arose, one would like to correct it. It is the fact that the separateness of the two bothers me. The separateness of the two. And it is only that it really achieves an edge that really can cut. The moment, I mean, when it kind of enters, as you say, again. And now, whether we begin as children so concrete, I wonder, you know, maybe we do, but then as teenagers we suddenly lose it again. There is certainly a give and take between thinking and perception. And I was leaning backwards here, because it seems that many people kind of take for granted that abstract thinking is hard. This is really something, this must be learned. And they think somehow that really to pinpoint perceptions of the uniqueness of something is easy. I found it often that it is easier with my students really to talk about some abstract problem than to make them really see or ask them to really make concrete a certain perception. It's much harder. It seems that this doesn't mean that the one can do without the other. I agree with you that the two have to come together. And of course today here, I was doing abstract thinking. I thank you that you think I did. Yes?
Do you know, is the Job considered the oldest drama in literature? I was told that in a dramatic course that I...
Well, I wouldn't know, I mean, whether... I'm not that competent, I think, to speak on that, whether there are any fragments, Egyptian fragments, or something that antedate that. I think I would certainly say it is perhaps the most moving, complete, you know, the drama. Perhaps, I mean, I wouldn't know any other. I think the Book of the Dead, the Egyptian Book of the Dead, I mean, has some discourse between the soul, you know, and so forth, which point that direction. But nothing, I think, of this completeness and this kind of really. It's the first complete portrait, you know, of a great human being in torment, and certainly drama. I would agree with that. Yes.
Isn't the concept of humility a such one which would make a man a poet, or anyone who tries to witness to Christ in all humility? Then he grasps at that which is at hand, and he seizes the concrete to express this universal. I'm thinking of somebody like Heidegger, for example, on Forbin and his poem behind his poem and so on, and
and how he tries with his philosophy to let it become a complete meaning again by using the force. And when he's with the theologians at Marburg, he complains because he says, everybody here is talking philosophy, where is the gospel? Because the kind of humility that wants to actually communicate is lost when we're just trying to impress each other with the abstraction. And he himself was asking for this kind of an expression of this, this gospel behind the gospel, at least just for the concrete. I think it's Craven here in Art in America, which is the only real American artist so far that has emerged as a Negro preacher. Because everything is sacred to his communication of his message. And he brings it in all its homeliness and concreteness to his ears. It's this quality of preaching that excites when humility is behind it, that wants to communicate and not sort of stand up here and tell you people down there something.
It's humility before, I mean, it's reality, but also humility towards the instrument that you use. You know, if you have seen a violinist cherish his Stradivarius, and how he wears mittens or something, you know, to warm his hands so it wouldn't freeze, you know, and then you think so many speakers, how they mishandle language. It is really frightening. And I would like to add to what you said, Sir Hinderly, that St. Francis certainly is my favorite theologian poet. And he's the patron saint of all poets, so I am no exception. And after all, he wrote the first great poem in the Italian language, which exists as a hymn that we sing. Of course, it's based on the Psalms, where he addresses the sun and the moon and the death and so on. There you have this. And he certainly didn't mind even preaching of the fishes, you know, and the birds.
Is it a fact that the greatest poetry is the most naked simplicity? Isn't it a part of our genius to be involved? I've seen a cartoon of a lady wanting to buy a mousetrap, and the man said this was by all odds the best. So she said, haven't you got something more ingenious?
Mm-hmm.
It was so simple, she didn't want it.
Mm-hmm. Did you...
I think of this in the sense of what you've been saying in conveying and relating.
Mm-hmm.
Except ye become as little children.
Mm-hmm.
Now this is a capacity for which we have no yen whatsoever. In fact, we try to mask that we're anything but that. But the point of contact is one of utter simplicity. And that's why I ask the question, if poetry at its best is not the most simple, if it's going to relate to the human situation.
Well, it's I wouldn't be able to answer that with a yes or a no. I think, for example, McGill here, he takes three modern poets, and he takes T.S. Eliot, who's rather difficult, you see, and he says he explores the city speech and the city kind of situation and its suffering. Then Robert Frost, who speaks out of the country, you see, country speech, and says, well, you know, it's the native grain, you see, which you must follow, and this simplicity and kind of directness which really counts and is genuine. But then he takes the third poet, Wallace Stevens, and he entitles that chapter Artificial Speech. And he says that Wallace Stevens says that there are some things that our kind of common speech and the simplicity simply doesn't capture. There are some very essential parts of human experience which have to be approached with a different kind of instrument, and that's what he does. And so I think that this sounds very persuasive, this naked simplicity. I myself have used it often and in sympathy with it, but then again I think there are different ways to the truth, and there are many, you know, there are many rooms in God's mansion. And I don't know, it's maybe somebody gets to this deepest insight in a very involved way, and somebody else in this naked simplicity.
I'm thinking in terms of in the crisis situation. It's amazing how simple we get.
Yes.
When a child is afraid and seems to be neglected and pushed out, the pleas that that child makes are basically very simple and responsive.
Yes.
I remember one of the stories I heard from school days about a fellow who came in all excited and said there was a fire on the campus, by the panel. And somebody said to me, "Where is it?" And then he became potentially profound. They, for some reason or other, didn't specify. It was so unnatural to the crisis, you see.
Yes.
I think in connection with that, becoming as other children, is the fact that when children are small, they are quite original. Well, I mean, in the case of it, it's quite original. They are original. But I wonder if this isn't part of what the Lord meant when we were becoming as little children, that we were going to recapture this originality, this
immediacy, yes.
Other people are saying around you, and the fact that maybe you don't make the transition, the children don't. They assume that you are living in the same reality they are.
Yes, I think that's a very, very, very fine point. I mean, because I think it's not so much the simplicity as it is this openness, this fact that they are really, they have no defense. I mean, the world impinges on them so directly and so painfully. I mean, they laugh and they cry, I mean, within a few minutes, because they're so absolutely open and defenseless. And I think that the process of growing up very often is a flight from reality. It's a flight from reality. We encapsulate ourselves in cliches, in our own thinking what the reality is, and we really close ourselves. And it takes some shock, it takes wisdom, it takes maturity to break out of this again and say, really, I don't know what the tree is. I mean, and a flower is a marvelous thing, but you are a fool. I mean, there's a grown-up, if you say, I mean, look at this tree, look at that fiber, look at these leaves. Is it amazing, you know? I mean, they say, well, what's the matter with you, you know? I mean, you know, second childhood or something? See? So I think this is very good. I think it's not simplicity, but it is this immediacy which does not cut you off from reality. This is another theme, I think, you know, what is reality and illusion? Because I think really most of us live in an illusion, because you cannot be bored with the world. You can be bored with it if you don't perceive anymore real objects, real pain, real happiness. You have this jadedness in the city person, I mean, who just is going, I think some of them call it a dream world. Nothing really ever enters them deeply, nothing really ever impinges upon them. And so they're bored, because there's a monotony that they have themselves created. Even a city street, there's variety. But if you aren't open to it, of course, nothing. Even a fire on the campus, you know, won't impress you. Nothing. Well, I think we have gone into the intercession already.
One thing I'd like to say, though, that I would like to have you make more so, and that's the experience we have when you're meeting poetry with us here, that sacramental moment of identity that poetry always creates. When the language and the imagery is in common, we are all together reading, teaching, and confessing this gospel that's communicated. And poetry gives that commonness to us, this universality, that gives us, you know, that moment we all sense, that sacramental touch of one another in the Lord, that is what even speech gives, doesn't it? When it becomes real, when it's presented. And this, I think, is what I think this kind of speech does for folk. Then we're not being preached at, but we are proclaiming together this resurrection. I'll go down to the best of the circle, and then we'll go.
Pardon?
Well, I don't have any here, you see. I think they're pretty.